Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this class, the Introduction to Logic. As you know, logic is a branch of philosophy. And one of the best definitions of philosophy that I encountered was from my friend, Father James Sadowski at Fordham, who told me he likes to tell his classes that the word philosophy comes from the Greek word philosophia, which means philosophy. So I think that one is a very helpful definition. Now, before I go on to the content of the lecture for today, I want to tell you a little bit about how the course is organized. For those of you who've taken Mises Academy courses before, or my courses in particular on Mises Academy, this will be familiar to you. I lecture generally for about an hour or so, and then there's a half hour for questions. You can go to the Q&A set box on your screen and type in your question. And also, during the lecture, you can type in comments in the chat section. And I also, after each weekly lecture, there's a quiz that consists just of multiple choice questions. Taking that is strictly voluntary. You don't have to take that to be in the course. And I don't make the quizzes very difficult. They're just designed to help you and see if you draw your attention to some of the main points of the lecture. As you'll find out during the course, I'm an incorrigible joke teller, so I try to make some of the choices on the multiple choice. I try to make them a bit on the funny side. Of course, you get extra points if you laugh at my comments. Now, first I want to say, what are we doing in this course? Well, we're having a logic course. Now, if you take a course in college in logic, some of you may have done that, there are really two kinds of courses you can take in logic. One is what would be called formal logic or mathematical logic, and the other is critical, something that they usually have a title of something like critical thinking. Now, formal logic is really a branch of mathematics that's dealing with certain formulas, what's called in well-formed formula in mathematical logic. You would, if you took that kind of class, you'd be proving theorems and learning things just like you would, say, in a math course. If you took geometry, you'd find mathematical logic very similar. So that's not what we're going to be doing in this course. Not there's anything wrong with mathematical logic, but that's not what my primary interest is in the course. What I'm trying to do in this course is teach critical thinking. What we do in that, we're trying to analyze arguments, and these arguments are in ordinary language. We're not using mathematical symbols. Sometimes there are a few letters, as you'll see if you look at the textbook, but we're basically looking at ordinary language. We're trying to see what are good arguments and what are bad arguments. So in each lecture, including this one, I'm going to be spending quite a bit of time giving you samples of arguments, and we'll try to see what's wrong with these. I'm going to be showing you examples of important fallacies. Now, a lot of these fallacies have names in Latin, like ignoratio elenchi, or suggestio falsi. But the important thing isn't to learn the names in Latin, it's just to realize what the patterns are, correct argument, what is a good argument, what is a bad argument. Now, some courses that you'll take, many courses you take in critical thinking, would still give you some mathematical logic, because they would give you the basic mathematical logic, and they use that to help you analyze the argument. So just in the way I'm saying, what we're going to be doing is analyzing the argument. In many courses in critical thinking, what you do is analyze the arguments, and then you convert these arguments into the symbols and mathematical logic, and that would help you evaluate the argument. So the question obviously arises, why didn't I do that in this course? Now, one answer might suggest itself to you, which I don't think is right, is maybe I don't know mathematical logic, but that isn't, I'm sure my knowledge could be improved, but that isn't the right answer, at least not the answer I'd like, not the answer you need if you want to pass this course. But the reason I've chosen this older textbook by George Joyce is that if you work with that, you don't have to convert the arguments into symbols. In mathematical logic, once you've got the argument in symbols, then you can really, it's pretty easy, then you can find out whether an argument is good or not just by fairly mechanical rules. But the problem is mathematical logic, if you're using it on an argument in words, is converting all the premises, all the statements into the acceptable math form that you need for your formula. It's just like if some of you, I'm sure most of you have taken elementary algebra in high school or college, you get word problems. A lot of these are complicated because you have to figure out how to get them into equations. So that's really the problem that you have in trying to do mathematical logic, that you have to convert all these statements and verbal statements into symbols. So what I'm doing is the book by George Joyce teaches kind of an older style logic that is called scholastic logic. It's kind of developed from Aristotle's logic by thinkers in the Middle Ages, and it was refined after them. So George Joyce was an English Jesuit, a member of the Society of Jesus. And he published this book we're using. It's a famous series of textbooks that were used by English Jesuits. It gives you a very good perspective on this reasoning in ordinary language. So the basic reason I chose that book is I think it's easy to analyze arguments using the way this Joyce sets his system up. You'll find it easier to use than I think you would if you were doing this in mathematical logic. And also, for those of you who take in mathematical logic, I think it's very helpful to get another way of doing things. Now, before I get on to what's on this first slide, one other point that's a bit different from in this book, the one we're doing by Joyce, that's different from what you're getting in mathematical logic class. In symbolic or mathematical logic, what we have, as I said before, are a set of formulas, just like you would have equations in algebra or other branches of mathematics. But what Joyce and scholastic logic generally are stressing are not the formulas, but acts of thought. So in this scholastic way of thinking, what we're studying in logic is acts of people's thought, various acts, as you'll see when you read books, we can form concepts, we can make judgments, we can have arguments. So these are all acts that we make. And this is so we're not, as a mathematical logic, simply taking a set of formulas, considering acts that people make. And another reason, again, why we're interested in this book is it's very similar in Austrian economics for those of you who are interested in that subject. Remember, in Austrian economics, we're studying the nature of human action. So this is a rather similar approach to logic. We're studying the nature of certain kinds of human acts of thought. Now, the key to logic, the really basic principle is, it's a rather remarkable phenomenon, is in logic, it's a way of moving from one true statement to other true statements. Suppose we have certain statements that we know are true, or certain assertions, but an assertion is just a claim that something is true. Say, I say, I'm giving a lecture now. That's a claim that something is true. So what we do in logic is, if we have certain true statements, then we can get other statements from them if we follow the correct rules of logic. So if something is true and we deduce something else from it, we're following these rules of logic correctly, then the conclusion is going to be true too. We don't have to investigate the conclusion to see whether it's true or not. Let's take kind of a standard example. We'll be seeing this in some of the later lectures. Suppose we say, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Now, if these first two statements, all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, are both true, then the conclusion is going to be true, too, that Socrates is mortal. We don't have to do any independent investigation to find out if it's true. Given that the premises are true, then the conclusion is guaranteed to be true also. And the key thing we're doing in logic is to try to find out, how do we do that? How do we go from true statements to more true statements? So it's a way that we can extend our knowledge. If we have true statements, then we can get more true statements. Now, one thing that's really essential to grasp if we're going to understand logic is a distinction between truth and validity. Is really, now wait, I see a comment here, someone says, we cannot know for sure. Daniel, what is it that you think we can't know for sure? I'm not quite clear on that. Well, all right, so what is truth? That's something sort of common sense, when I say something is true, we're making a claim about reality. So I say, Ron Paul is running for president. That's true if and only if Ron Paul is running for president. So you say, claim something is true, you're saying the world is that way. Now, validity is something else. Sometimes people use valid as a synonym for true, but this isn't the way it's used in logic. In logic, a valid conclusion is one that follows the rules of logic. So if you're following the rules of logic, you come up with certain conclusions, start off with certain statements, and then you correctly get to other statements, you follow the rules of logic, then your argument is valid. That just means that you've followed the rules correctly. So it doesn't mean that your conclusion is true. Now, can anybody see, from what I said so far, why not? Suppose we have a valid conclusion, we follow the rules of logic, why can't we be sure yet that the conclusion is true? Does anybody want to try that one? Yes, and Justin said the premises might not be true. That's entirely correct. all we know if an argument is valid is that it follows from the premises. If we start off with certain true premises and we reason validly, then the conclusion is also true. But we don't know the conclusion is only guaranteed to be true only if the premises are true. So it's easy to remember the basic point we're trying to go in logic from true statements to other true statements. If we follow the rules, then we're reasoning validly. But to do that, we have to have true statements to start with. If we don't have true statements, then it's not guaranteed the conclusion is true. So what happens if we start with statements that aren't true? Then we can't tell anything without further investigation whether the validly deduced conclusion is true or false. You just have, it could be either depending on the case. So what we have to remember is, this is an important distinction, truth, if we say something is true, you're making a claim about the world. You're saying the world is a certain way. It's true that Obama is now the president. But if you say something is valid, you're saying you followed the rules of logic to arrive at your conclusion. Now, what I said so far, now we're getting into the subject of the reading for this lecture. We said so far, we're moving from, in deduction, we're moving from true statements to other true statements, which we're going to learn in logic certain rules. How do you do that? So then, well, we want to know, what is a statement or an assertion? Well, that's a claim that something is true. Assertion is just an ordinary term in language. Now, then we have the further thing, further topic is, well, what, let's look at an assertion. What does an assertion consist of? Well, in the system that Joyce is using in this book, an assertion is a joining together of two concepts. So we have, in the way Joyce is thinking of things, each assertion has two concepts. And then deduction is how we, so we have, say we have in deduction, we have two assertions, each one of them has two concepts. And we get to a new concept through deduction. So what we have to do now is say, well, deduction consists of assertion, assertion consists of concept. So now we have to figure out what is a concept. Well, a concept, and this is a very straightforward matter to understand, a concept is an idea we have of something. We can have concepts of really anything we can think about. Like we could have, whether a thing exists or not, we have a concept of a unicorn, a concept of a table. A concept is just whatever it is we're thinking about. Now, in the chapter, Joyce has some philosophically very interesting things to say about concepts, or at least I think they're interesting. I hope you think so also. Now, he distinguishes between a concept and a mental picture. Let's say I can see a table. If I look to my left, you can't see the table unless there's something really going wrong with the video, but I can see a table. Now, if I wanted to, I could probably picture a table to myself, this table to myself. I could kind of close my eyes and get kind of a mental image of the table. But according to Joyce, if I did that, that wouldn't be the concept. The mental picture I have which he calls, and this is kind of an old scholastic term, the phantasm. That sounds like one of these superheroes, but it isn't. It's a scholastic term for picture. So the mental picture is not the same as a concept. Why not? Well, Joyce says in a concept is really something we could apply over and over again. If I have a concept of a table, it doesn't just refer to this particular table that I'm looking at, but I can apply it to different tables, all sorts of other tables. So a concept is kind of an abstract idea, and a mental picture is something very particular. I have a mental image. That wouldn't tell me anything about other tables. It would just be an image of a particular table, just kind of a mental picture. Now, Joyce, who's a follower of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, has the view that the way we get concepts is by abstracting them from these pictures. So according to Joyce, well, say we look at a table and then we kind of see, well, what are some features of this picture that other tables could have, that we might have other tables in common would have also. We can get an abstraction of this. So instead of just having a picture of one table, we kind of get a general idea of table. So that's how we get the concept of table from the mental picture. I should say, for those of you who are familiar with Ayn Rand's philosophy, I gave a course on that last year. This is the view she has of how we get concepts also. It's similar to that. But what it isn't essential in logic that we adopt this view of how we get concepts. All that we need to be clear about is that the concept is an abstraction. It's universal, so it's different from a mental picture. You don't have to hold that we get the mental picture by abstraction you get the concept by abstraction from mental picture. That is one popular view, it's a view Joyce holds, but what you really need to do is get this distinction between the mental picture and the abstraction, the concept. As I say, the concept is universal. It applies to not just particular image that we're seeing, but it applies to an indefinite number of other things. If I have a concept of a table, I could apply that wherever I encounter a table. Now, you might think, my interesting observation, you might say, well, isn't there an exception to this? Suppose I say I have a concept of a person, I know Danny Sanchez, who's the one who gets you into all the, enrolls you in the course and solves all your problems. Fortunately, you're not dependent on me to solve these problems. You'd really be in trouble if I had to do these things. So I say I have a concept of Danny. He's someone I can think about. But it doesn't follow that there are an indefinite number of Danny Sanchez's around. There's just one of him. So you might say, well, isn't this an exception? I said concepts are universal, but there's just one Danny. But still, there's a universal aspect of it that I can refer to the Danny on different occasions. I can mean by when I say speak of Danny today or last week, I can still refer to the same person, and whereas if I had a picture of him in my mind's eye, that would just be limited to particular things. So I still have, I have a think of a person or a particular, this the concept of a person but still have a universal aspect to it. And one thing Joyce mentions is that he classifies concepts in various ways. I don't think we need to go into all the different ways he classifies concepts. A lot of the scholastics like all making distinctions of all sorts, and they have very elaborate tables of all sorts of possible distinctions. So I'm not going to go into all of those, but one that's important, he says certain concepts are repugnant, that they don't go together. For example, something couldn't be both circular and square at the same time. So this repugnant concept is very similar to those of you who will be dealing with slavery called the law of contradiction or non-contradiction, so which is talking about propositions that are judgments that can't both be true, such as, suppose I say, I am a man and I am not a man. Those both propositions, the judgments, can both be true at the same time. So there are concepts that are repugnant in the sense that both these concepts couldn't apply to the same thing at one time. It's quite similar to a contradictory judgment. And as I said, just to reiterate, the essential thing in concept, it's an idea that we have of something. So we really think with concepts. A concept is just an idea. It's not some kind of obscure philosophical notion. It's just what we mean in ordinary language by an idea of something. And one thing I should say also before we leave mental pictures, a concept isn't just kind of a mental picture with details left out. That would just be kind of vague picture. Say I just kind of a blurry picture. That isn't a concept. A concept is an act of thought, and when we have a concept, we were able to apply it to different instances. It isn't just a picture with details left out. It's one we can apply to all sorts of instances. Now, one thing Joyce has a distinctive view of concepts that's a controversial one. If you study, say, logic in mathematical logic, you would get different view of concepts from the one that Joyce has. But his system, as I say, I think is a very interesting one to study. So this is what I'm going to be going over now. So what Joyce says is the terms in our language that we use in these judgments, suppose I say, let's take a judgment. Remember, judgment is an assertion that something is true. Let's take a kind of a trite example. Socrates is a man. So what Joyce holds is in any judgment, what we have is two concepts. In this one, we have Socrates and man. And each of these terms, Socrates and man, is naming an object, and it's naming the object by having a certain concept in view. Suppose I say, let's look at it again, Socrates is a man. Well, I have the word Socrates is naming the man Socrates, so that's the object, and it's naming him. How am I able to name him Socrates? Well, I have a concept, Socrates. So I'm naming Socrates, Socrates, because I have this concept. And I have the concept, I'm naming man by that word, man, because I have a concept of man. So this sounds pretty obvious, but what's distinct about scholastic logic is that it says all propositions are of this kind. Every proposition contains two names, and both the subject and predicate are names. So this is called, and you won't be surprised, the two-name theory of a proposition. Now there's one very famous logician philosopher, Peter Geech, who's I think over 90 now, who's one of the great logicians. He can't stand this theory. He calls this, he has these fulminations against the two-name theory of a proposition, but it still turns out that you can convert any judgment that you have into this two-name theory, and Joyce shows how you can work with it. Now, let's go again to the judgment that I used to give you the example of the two-name theory. Socrates is a man. Now, Socrates is a name, it's a proper name, just say, as I see Sam looking at some of the names here, I see Tom, Brandon, L. These are all names, so they're naming particular people. Now, according to the way Joyce is looking at things, here he's following John Stuart Mill, who's a great British philosopher and logician in the 19th century. A proper name doesn't tell you anything about the object. Suppose, let's say, you see my name is David. That wouldn't tell you about any qualities I have. I mean, suppose it's true of me that I like bad jokes, but you wouldn't get that just from the name David. Supposing you could have somebody named David who didn't tell bad jokes. It wouldn't be me, but you could still have such a thing. So a proper name doesn't tell you anything about the object. Now, can anybody see an objection that you might give to that claim, that a proper name doesn't tell you anything about the object? Now, what was what building it? Someone said the Eiffel Tower is a tower. But I mean, supposing, let's say, you named your dog Eiffel Tower, you wouldn't be making a mistake. You would, I mean, just from the fact that you're naming something, you couldn't. It wouldn't follow that it had, I mean, you could name it Eiffel Tower, but it wouldn't follow it have to be a tower just because you give it that name. So the objection I was expecting was, well, couldn't you say the name, say from the name David, wouldn't you be able to, someone be able to deduce that I'm male, you wouldn't give a female the name David. So couldn't you deduce from that you do know something about just from the name, namely that I'm a man? Or you might say, well, wouldn't you know that I'm a person rather than an animal of some kind? But that wouldn't follow, you see, because suppose somebody just had an odd sense of how people should be named, say he named his daughter David. He hasn't made a mistake, he's just picked an unusual name, or you could name your pet Lot David. So you see, just from the fact you give somebody the proper name, nothing follows about the object. Now, suppose though you can refer to a particular person, a particular object, by a proper name, when you're not, if you do that, you're not saying anything about the object. However, you can, if you want to, refer to a particular by a description rather than a name. Now, you might say, well, how could you do that? Because haven't we said before, remember, we're talking about a concept. This is an abstract term. Like, say, table can apply to all sorts of tables, any indefinite number of tables. They're all tables. So suppose you want to refer just to one particular table. How could you do that by using by using concepts rather than proper names? If I use concepts that are all these abstractions, I'm not here not taking a name as a concept, just taking concept kind of as a universal or an abstraction. How could I refer to a particular object just by using concepts? Wouldn't I have to put in a proper name some way? And Joy says, no, because I could just keep adding concepts so that they only, in fact, apply to one entity. In Modern Logic, some version Russell wrote, famous paper 1905, Joyce calls this a significant singular term, but it could be called now a definite description. Suppose I said something like, the Queen of England in 2012. Now, the Queen of England, you see, doesn't refer to one particular person. There have been a lot of Queens of England, maybe not that many, but quite a few. But by saying the Queen of England in 2012, I get it down to one person, namely Queen Elizabeth II. So by adding concepts and putting them together, I can get a reference to a singular term. And this is what we can Joyce calls a significant singular term. And I can also do that if I want to refer to a particular thing rather than abstract idea. I can do that by giving it a proper name. And when I say your proper names are non-connotative, that just means it's just reiterating the point I made before, that a proper name doesn't imply any qualities about the object. If I say something like, I give somebody the name Ludwig von Mises. Mises was, as you know, a great Austrian economist, but that wouldn't follow just from his name. Just calling him Ludwig von Mises would just be a way of picking him out. It wouldn't be asserting anything about him or indicating that he had any particular properties. Now, Joyce makes another important distinction here between positive and negative terms. And this is pretty straightforward. A positive term is one that is saying is of something that it has a certain quality. I suppose we say something is circular. Well, that's saying it has that quality. It's round in the way that a circle is round. But I could also have a negative term, which is denying that something has a particular quality. Suppose I said something is non-circular. I wouldn't be saying what shape the thing had. I would just be denying that it had the shape of a circle. So it could be anything but a circle. So that's a way, important distinction. That one, I think, is pretty easy to get. Now, one that sometimes gives a bit of trouble, and this is one that's very important to understand, is the distinction between contradictory and contrary opposition. Now, contradictory opposition is something like that divides everything into two classes. Like we say circular and non-circular. So we say everything is either circular or non-circular. There's nothing in between, either one or the other. My particular instances have difficulty figuring out which is which, but it has to be whatever it is will be in one of the either circular or non-circular. So contrary opposition is different from that. Contrary opposition is something like that things are at opposite extremes. So we have something that is classed in a number of different ways, and that contrary is the one that's the furthest extreme. For example, tall and short are terms in contrary opposition. There something doesn't say a person, we could say some people are short, some people are tall, but you don't have to be either one. So we could imagine people ranged in various heights, say I'm pretty short, you have to say people taller than me, or some people shorter than I am. So you could have people ranged from the shortest dwarf to the tallest giant. So we could say the contrary, say the ones at either extreme, tall and short, but you wouldn't have to be either. You could have people who are kind of average height or not much different from average. So they're neither short nor tall. So whereas with contradictory opposites, everything is either one or the other, that doesn't have to be the case with contrary opposite. So that's an important distinction. Now, the last term that I'll mention that Joyce mentioned, that discussed it, and I say, Joyce, when you read this chapter, it gives a whole lot of different distinctions, but I'm just giving a few that I think are especially important. And this is a very scholastic distinction between first and second intention. So first intention refers to objects in the world like that, going back again, looking at a computer screen. I'm talking about first intention, I mean the actual computer screen I'm now looking at. So that's first intention. I'm talking about an object in the world. Now, second intention means I'm talking about not the object, but the concept of the object. So here, I wouldn't be talking about the computer screen, the thing that's actually out there that I'm looking at. I'd be talking about the concept computer screen. So that would be a term in second intention. Now, in modern logic, I think it's a little easier. You would indicate this distinction by quotation marks. So what would be second? So suppose I said that here's a rather old joke: is what's the longest word in English? And the answer is smiles, because there's a mile between the two S's. So see, this joke relies on confusing first and second intention, because what's between the two S's in the word is the word mile. It's not that there's a physical distance of a mile long between the two S's. You see, it's just that there's the letters M-I-L-E are between the two S's, so that's the whole joke. So you see, it's a good way of remembering this distinction between first and second intention. The first intention we're talking about the physical object. The second intention we're talking about the words or the concept. You remember I said at the beginning of the lecture, I want to devote each lecture some time to pointing out various ways of reasoning about and various fallacies to avoid. And I want to do that now, and I selected a few that we're going to discuss now. I'm going to do this in each lecture. We'll give you examples where of bad arguments, and we'll see what's wrong with it. Now, the first one I've chosen from the well-known economist Paul Krugman. Now, what you'll see if you click on this, the climate of hate, you'll see what the whole story is. I'm not going to click on it right now, but because I know I'm technically inept, I drove myself off the entire lecture. But I'll give you a summary of what he was saying. Now, he was referring to the very sad event that happened last year. Remember, someone shot this Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, and she was very seriously injured and killed several people. So what Krugman suggests is we should have expected something like this to happen. And why is that? He says, well, there was a climate of hate. People were, especially people who he considers very right wing, were making all sorts of threats to leftist or more liberal politicians. And they were, he says, well, isn't it bound to be the case if you have all these threats, people are making these violent threats, somebody's going to carry them out, somebody's going to take them seriously. So you say, well, all people who believe vote for Obamacare should be executed or should be killed, somebody's going to go out and shoot one of them. So what I'm concerned with again here is not whether what he's saying is factually correct or is political things. I'm just interested in the structure of the argument. And what I want to point out is what he was saying illustrates two important fallacies that you'll find very useful to in studying argument. Now, the first, what he's saying is, let's look at the first one, which we could call usually called the base rate fallacy. What he's saying is, well, look, if there are all these threats that we're going to, people making all these violent threats, that we're going to get rid of various people, isn't it likely that someone's going to actually carry out one of the threats? Well, what is the fallacy here? He certainly seems, it seems plausible that if people are making all sorts of threats, that that will increase the chances that someone's going to go out and do something to someone. That certainly seems like something would increase the probability that something will happen, something like that would happen. But can you see what is the jump he's making there to what he wants to say, that you shouldn't have been surprised by this? Can anyone see what's wrong there? Let me see if anybody have any suggestions here. Someone says, did atrocity refer to Krugman? So, okay, well, what he's, the mistake he's making, and this is what the base rate fallacy is, he's confusing increasing the chances that something will happen with making it likely that the thing will happen. Those are two very different things. Let me give you an example. Supposing, say, I buy a ticket in the lottery and I have, say, a 1 in 10 million chance of winning the lottery. Now, suppose I then buy another ticket. I've doubled the chances that I'll win the lottery because I now have two tickets instead of one. But I certainly haven't made it likely or more likely than not that I'll win the lottery. It's still extremely unlikely. So you see, that's very easy to see what's wrong there. But Krugman has committed really the same fallacy as someone would make who thought because he bought two tickets, because he increased, doubled the chance of winning the lottery, that it was likely to win the lottery. What Krugman has neglected is shooting members of Congress or politicians is a very rare event. It doesn't happen very often, so it's extremely unlikely to begin with that anyone is going to shoot a member of Congress. I mean, there have been various presidents assassinated, but that doesn't happen very often. So it's very unlikely to begin with that someone's going to be, the Congress person is going to be shot. So even if he's right, again, we're not interested in the factual accuracy, what he said, he's right that what he calls a climate of hate will increase the chances that someone will be shot, it doesn't make it more likely than not or probable that the person will be shot. And I remember I said when I started with this example that Krugman's article illustrates two fallacies. Now the other fallacy is this. This is what's called ignoring the issue, or ignoratio elenchi in the Latin. Remember, you don't have to remember the Latin. So what he seems to want to explain in the article is the particular act of violence committed by the person who shot Gabriel Giffrey. But it turns out that that person wasn't particularly a right-wing person who was influenced by all these, this climate of violence. It was, I think, someone who had mental problems. So what he's done here is he's given an argument, which isn't a good one because it's a space rates fallacy, that we would expect someone to be shot, but he hasn't explained why this particular person has been shot, because that doesn't fit the pattern he had in mind. So he's really committed two fallacies there, two for the price of one. I suppose that's how you win a Nobel Prize, if you can commit enough fallacies in a short space of time. Now, I now want to go to a few examples from a book. I might do a review of, I'm supposed to do a review some time ago, but I'm very late getting up my work. It's a book by a writer on economics called John Madai. And what he says he defines a just wage in a certain way, people taking out of the system no more than they put in production. So a just wage, people are getting what they produce. He says this is equilibrium. Well, you can define that any way you want. But he then says, well, just wages, namely people who are taking out no more than they produce, will support a family. He says, well, how do we know that they do that? He says it's absurd to suppose that they won't. It's absurd to suppose that just wages won't support a family. Because then, if we said that, then economics would become an absurd science with no purpose. So I think now here the fallacy is very simple. The conclusion has nothing to do with what he said in the argument. This is just what they call non sequitur. It just doesn't follow. If, say, wages weren't in a particular historical situation, wages weren't enough to support the family, then that would just be a fact about the world. No doubt being an unfortunate fact about the world. But it wouldn't make the science of economics absurd if that were really the case. So he said something that just doesn't follow at all from what he said to begin with. And then he goes on for another non-sequitur. He said, if economics in general, systems in general just don't work, then we must choose between chaos or Keynesianism. Again, you can see complete non-sequitur. This guy is worse than Krugman, because at least with Krugman you have to figure out what's wrong with what he's saying. This guy just makes obvious mistakes. So that's why I picked him, because you can illustrate this non-sequitur. if economic systems just didn't work properly, why would we have to choose between chaos or kingdom? It just doesn't follow at all. Now, I like picking on people, so let's continue with him. Now, he wants to say now, he says, property is originally owned by the community. And he says the idea of purely private property is a contradiction because the right to private property must be recognized by the community having value. For example, the owner must be able to call upon the police to be able to exclude others from his property, or his property can't be said to be private at all. Well, here he's made two mistakes, again, two non-sequiturs. Now, he's certainly right. Suppose, let's say I own my apartment, but or I own my computer, but then someone else comes and takes it, and I'm not able to stop them. It wouldn't follow from that I don't really own it. It would just be I'm not able to enforce my claim. Now, he's certainly right that if you own something and other people in general don't recognize that you own it, say other people ignore your claim, then you won't be able to exercise your claim, you won't be able to get other people to accept your claim. But that doesn't follow that if you don't have a valid claim to it. It would just be that other people are violating your rights. So he's assuming there that unless other people follow, observe your rights, you don't have rights. So I mean, this doesn't seem like something, seems like rather obviously false. We say, for example, that there are people who are in a concentration camp don't have any rights, that the people who put them there don't recognize they have any rights. Then the second fallacy is, suppose we ignore that. Suppose we say people don't have rights to property unless other people recognize that they have such rights. I don't think we should say that, but suppose we did say that. It wouldn't follow that the property is owned by the entire community, that there isn't individual property. We would then say we'd have a system of individual property where everyone recognized everyone else's rights. So again, he's very good. He has complete non sequiturs. So I just picked him out, you know, so we can just see what we mean by non sequiturs. You read this, you have to ask, when you're reading an argument, you say, does what the person says follow from what he says it does? And we'll be seeing, of course, when we're analyzing syllogism, we'll find out what that means in the later lecture, exactly how we do that. I guess I'm picking on him, but I just want to go over quickly. Another thing he says, here again, he says, imagine that we're trying to figure out, say, capital, how much capital labor contributed to a certain product. Like imagine somebody who's working in a factory with a machine, he's producing shoes. So we say, how much is due to the shoe and how much is due to the machine, how much is due to the person's labor. So he says, we can't figure this out, but what he says, we can't figure it out which factor of production is responsible for which amount, but his argument is we can't figure this out mathematically, we have to make a judgment about it. Well, how would it follow from the fact we have to make a judgment about it that we can't make such a judgment about it? He's saying, We have to make a judgment which contributes more. Say, does the machine contribute, say, so-and-so, does the labor contribute this? He says we can't reduce this to some kind of mathematical measurement. We have to make a judgment about it. But he concludes from that that we can't make any judgment about it at all. So again, you see a complete non sequitur. So enough on him. I like beating up on people, not students who take my classes, but just authors whose book I have to review. If you can't say something bad about a book, why say it at all? I thought I was finished with him, but I had one more. I guess I'm really somewhat sadistic, especially where this person is concerned. Now, here he's illustrated a different fallacy, and this is one of using a term in two meanings. So he says, he's asking, is economics a normative or a positive science? That means by that, is economics a sort of science that is describing reality or telling you how reality should be? Is it saying something like, he's just talking about the economic system, the system operates in a certain way, or is it making judgments about what a good or bad system should be? And he says every science is both positive and normative. And he says, why does he think that? Every science is what he calls normalized to some criteria of truth. So he says, well, supposing you're making a description of the economy, you have to have some standards of what is good reasoning or what is a good description. So he's saying you're using certain norms when you're doing that. So doesn't that mean the science is normative because you're using certain norms of reasoning or a description? But here, when people say, is economics a normative science, they mean, do you have to make value judgments in economics? Do you have to say something is, say, communism is a bad economic system? That would be a normative judgment. Is that kind of statement part of economics? Well, it wouldn't follow that it is, just because if you're making a good description, you have to have certain standards of reasoning or description. So he's completely changed the meaning of normative, and that's how he gets his conclusion, every science is normative. So see, this person, good thing he's not taking this class, you'd really be in trouble, probably get mad at me because I'm making fun of it. So the last example that I want to give is from a well-known economist, Robert Frank. So Robert Frank is someone who's very critical of libertarians. He said some libertarians have the view that taxation is illegitimate. Now, again, I hold that view myself, but we're not here talking about whether libertarianism is true or not. We're just considering, again, what this particular argument is. So this is something that's wrong, even if you're not a libertarian, to say what he's saying is wrong. He's saying, imagine that taxes were purely voluntary. So he thinks then we wouldn't be able to have roads or schools. So he says, really, there are certain essential services that we have to have a government to provide. Now, as I say, I don't accept that myself, but supposing that he's right, say we have to have in society, we have to have certain essential services, and we couldn't rely on voluntary taxation to provide these. So again, I don't think that's right, but we're just assuming, we're saying, okay, let's assume he's right. We need to have compulsory taxation to buy these essential services. So then he concludes from this, our best option is to have an intelligent conversation about what services we want government to provide and who should be taxed to pay for them. Because here, again, he's jumping to a much more radical conclusion than what his premise says, because his premise is, a society couldn't get along without certain essential services, and these have to be provided for by the government raising revenues through taxation. But it doesn't follow from that any other services have to be provided by government. Somebody could have a view, well, if we have to have a government, should be the least possible. We wouldn't have to open the door to further conversation, as he says, about which services we want the government to provide. Somebody could have the view government should provide only those services that we couldn't possibly get along without. And he hasn't ruled that out. So he's kind of sneaking in a much more radical conclusion than the one he started with. So, okay, so I think that'll be enough for the first lecture. So I'm now going to go to the Q&A section, and if you have questions or objections or comments, just type them into the Q&A and I'll try to answer them if I can. Tom asked, does the admission of relative truth have any effect on logic? Well, it would depend what you mean by relative truth. I think what I would want to claim is if you say something is true relative to something else, that itself would be a claim that isn't relative. So I would think you would just put that in. Suppose you said something like, relative to believing Catholics, abortion is wrong. So that would be a claim, then that statement relative to believing Catholics, abortion is wrong, wouldn't be true relatively. That would be a claim that would be claimed to be true straightforwardly. So I would think that it really wouldn't affect the logic because you could use the relative claim, would be the claim that something is relative would itself be a claim that would be true straightforwardly. Augustine has two questions. All scholastic logic can be transformed in formal logic. Yes, you could probably do that. I mean, it would be in certain systems of formal logic, they wouldn't view propositions in the way Joyce does. They wouldn't take a two-name view of concept, but you could certainly take a scholastic proposition and formalize it if you want. The second one, propagating called a phantasm. No, because the phantasm is a picture, like supposing I have a mental picture of, let's say, a dog that I call Fido. I like tried name for dog. I have a mental picture about Fido, but that isn't a concept of Fido. The concept would be I just call that dog Fido, and then I can use that name to refer to him. I'm just picking him out, but not through a description. So if you have a picture of something, you're not picking out anything, but a proper name enables you to pick something out and refer to it. David, as a concept closely related to the model, i.e. simplification, reality made to further understand of complexity. Well, a concept wouldn't have to be a simplification. You could have some concepts just give you, like a concept of a circle, would just give you the entire meaning of a circle. It wouldn't be a simple concept of a circle isn't a simplification of other properties that a circle has. It's just giving you the entire concept. There are, on the other hand, concepts that do just what you say. For example, Joyce gives an interesting case. Suppose we have a concept of a swan. Now, it's not part of the concept of a swan that it has the color white. And he said, one time people thought all swans were white, but then they discovered black swans in Australia. So he said, well, people didn't say, now we know that there couldn't be a black swan because it's part of the definition, part of the concept of swan, that it's white color. It just said, well, now we know they're black swans. So here, the concept swan would just have some of the properties of actual swan. Now, Thomas said, can you explain the Kruger example once more? It was even if you bought all the lottery tickets, you would increase your chances, you would increase the amount of hate speech, the probability of violent act could increase. Well, Thomas said, you're certainly right. You have two points here. You're certainly right that the probability of a violent act could increase. That seems like a plausible thing to say, to increase the amount of hate speech. The probability could increase. But what the fallacy is thinking from the fact that the probability is increasing, that it's increased to the point that it's likely to happen. Now, let's take your excellent example of the lottery ticket. If you bought all the lottery tickets, you'd certainly make it extremely likely that you'd win the lottery. You'd make it certain that you'd win the lottery. But just buying more than one wouldn't do that. So you see, I'm glad you asked the question. The basic decision is doing something that will increase the probability versus doing something that makes it likely to happen, that increases the probability to the extent that it's very likely to happen. Now, let me give you one other example. Let's suppose we invent an imaginary disease, let's call this Baldwin syndrome. And we say that Baldwin syndrome, if you have Baldwin syndrome, then you start to imitate a bald eagle. Let's say we're given only 5 people in the United States have Baldwin syndrome. So supposing there's a test we can take in the doctor's office that's 99% accurate on whether people have Baldwin syndrome. And let's say you take the test and it shows that you do have it. Remember, this test is 99% accurate. Is it now likely that you have Baldwin syndrome? And the answer is no, because if you thought it was, you'd be making this base rate fallacy. You'd be confusing the fact that you take the test, it makes it a lot, it increases the chances that you have this dread disease, Baldwin syndrome. But remember, there's only, when I say 5 people in the United States who have it in the first place, so it's very unlikely to begin with that you have it. So that's an example. The distinctions between something that increases the probability of something happening and something that makes it more likely than not that it happens. Let's see, there's one. David says, I understand there's a maximum loss effect that if you know not the name of a thing, all knowledge of it must perish. Is this compatible with what you said about limitation of a name? Well, here I think in this maxim, when they're talking about names, I think what they mean there is a concept of something, like something that, but when I was talking about limitation, I just meant proper names. Remember, in Joyce's system, all concepts are names. Like a table is a name, chair is a name. Every concept we have is a name, but not every name is a proper name. A proper name is just a sort of a pure name that doesn't tell you anything about the object that you're naming at all. Like I gave the example, I name this computer screen Charlie. Well, that doesn't tell you anything about the properties of the computer screen. So it wouldn't be the case that if you don't know the proper name of the thing, all knowledge of it must perish, because you don't know anything about it if you know the proper name. I think that's the proper name given. So when we're talking about names, they're referring just to name in the sense of concept. Now, Aaron says, what are the names of 2 fallacies in Kruger's line? Well, one is the base rate fallacy, and the other one, I called ignoratio elenchi. I can write that out there. You can look it up in Joyce is probably the best way to find it. It's ignoring the issue, and elenchus is this issue in disputes, or ignatio elenchi, it's a Latin phrase, ignoring the issue. Alcad says his likelihood, defined by probability greater than 50%, does not matter by this discussion of logic. Well, I sort of informally characterize likely to happen more likely than not, so it'd be greater than 50%. You wouldn't have to define it that way if you didn't want to, but you could still make the same distinction between something that increases the probability of something and something that makes it likely in any way you want to define it, except, of course, if you want to define it as increasing the probability of something. But if you want to pick something else's likelihood, you could do that. You'd still have the fallacy. Now, Adam said, is the assumption in scholastic logic, my concept thing is the same as someone else's through the use of ordinary language? Well, I don't think you'd be making an assumption that everyone would have the same concept. We would tend to think that generally the case, because the concept, remembering Joyce's, view is acquired by abstraction through particularism, people making, going through the same process. So he's tending to assume that people have the same, I think he is assuming people have the same concept, but it's not guaranteed that they would. You could imagine people have a different concept. Now, there are various interesting philosophical arguments, like Ludwig Wittgenstein, who is a famous philosopher of the 20th century, had arguments that people really have to be using the same concepts in order to speak a language. And this is much discussed in philosophy, but you wouldn't have to assume, like in Scholastic logic, everybody had absolutely the same concepts of everything. Now, Michael said, if you have a concept of a table as an object with four legs and horizontal slab on top, you see such an object in reality, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a table. Could it be a stool? How do we know the concept is valid? Well, remember, the concept, this is a very good question, a concept isn't something that's valid or not, because you're not making an assertion about things. A concept is simply an idea that you have of something. So if you had the concept of a table as an object of this kind, then you could consider, it would be up to you to consider anything that you want to say, that's what a table is. That would be your concept of a table. It might not correspond to what other people have in mind by a table, but if that was your idea of a table, that would be a table. So it isn't that our concepts are being judged by some kind of external standard. We could say, well, is this the correct concept or the wrong concept? It's the concept is just something that we get, an idea we have about something. So it's really up to us to what concept we have in mind. Now, I've got to say that we can think of an example of a third intangible concept. Well, do you have in mind something like this? Well, as I said, we could have further, as I said, we're talking about the word, something in quotation marks, as I said, the first intention concept is the computer screen, and the second intention concept is the concept computer screen. So imagine computer screen in quotation marks. So you might say, well, couldn't we have a third use of quotation marks around that? So we're talking about the concept of the concept computer screen. So we have further quotation marks. But see, that would be just considered another second intention concept, I think, in scholastic logic. But it's a good question. But I don't think that would be, they wouldn't have the notion of a third intention. That would be just an additional second intention concept, if I'm understanding your question. Okay, we still have a few minutes left. Anybody have anything else? How bad do you think my jokes are? Let me see anybody. Well, let's see. We have Henry has a thing in the sign. Says that thinking is problem solving. Do you agree? Well, I think that's one of the things that is, I don't think all thoughts would be problem solving, would they? I mean, supposing I'm now thinking of a pink rhinoceros. I'm thinking of pink rhinoceros, but I'm not offhand seeing what problem I'm solving by that. But I think he's right about one thing that's very important. For that we use thinking to solve problems, but I wouldn't go quite as far as he does. Aaron wants, and when do we have to take the quiz to get a grade? Well, I mean, Danny's the final arbiter on such things. You can have whatever time you want, just have it in before the course is over. Now, Tom says, would you address the difference between absolute and relative truth? Well, absolute truth is just kind of saying that something is true. Like, let's say, Tom, you asked the question, would you address the difference between absolute and relative truth? So that's just a statement I'm making that's true. I'm just saying any statement is just making a claim that something is making a claim that something is true. So that would be an absolute judgment. But the relative truth would be something saying you take a certain class and you'd say, considered relative to this, something is true. I suppose you said, looking from over here, that's a table. So you'd be saying, from this particular, looking from this standpoint, that's a table. So that wouldn't commit you to a claim, that's a table, in this absolute sense. You're just looking at it from over here, that's a table. So that would be as a relative claim. You'd be saying something is the case given something else, but you're not claiming that a thing is the case. You're just saying, given this, or as you said, Mark said, relative to bourgeois economics, capitalist wages are just. So that would be saying, according to what they call bourgeois economics, capitalist wage rates are just. That they wouldn't be committed to saying capitalist wage rates are just. They think they're unjust. But it's just, it would be the case that relative to this, say, this standpoint, then the claim is true. Now, Rod wants to know, the difference between first and second judgment, what Ayn Rand referred to as measurement omission. I don't think so. What she meant by measurement omission was just in reforming a concept, we omit particular details. Like, let's say, I look at all sorts of tables, they have all sorts of particular features, like one's made of wood, what each one is a certain size, and so on. But in, so that's what she means by measurement, is we kind of get a general idea, we just have a concept of a table. But first and second intention is different. First intention is talking about actual tables, the things out there in the world. And second intention is just talking about the concept of the table. So there's a similarity in that what you get as a result of a measurement and omission is a concept. But when you have the concept, this is the key distinction. It's a good question. We have the concept of a table in the Randian sense. You're not talking about your concept of the table, you're talking about actual tables. So the result of measurement and mission, you're still talking about first intention, because you're talking about actual things in the world, you're just omitting certain details. Scott wants to know, how can this be used when analyzing statistical data, say with a confidence interval of 90%? I'm not understanding. Do you mean something like if something is, you can be 90% confident of something? I'm not quite clear understanding that question. Maybe you could spell it out a bit more detail. I'm not really understanding that one. Now, Augustine says if truth is a concept, it means that there is an objective truth. That cannot be the case because truth is only a concept. Well, here, you know, you have to distinguish, getting back to Rod's question, between first and second intention. We can have a concept of truth, but what truth is referring to is what's out there in the world, but our concept of truth is an idea we have, but the concept of truth is about what's in the world. The concept refers to reality, but the concept itself is something in our mind. But what I think your question is overlooking is that our concepts are referring to reality. They're not referring to themselves. We can have concepts about other concepts, but the primary use of concept is to refer to reality. Okay, well, does anybody have maybe a last question or so? We still have another minute. Someone said looking forward to more lectures. Well, that person. And if someone says, is it true that there's no truth then? No, I wouldn't think that. If someone thinks we don't find certainty, well, I mean, I think some things are pretty certain. I mean, Joe says, we don't find certainty. Well, I mean, I don't think it's a question for being put out that you exist. Here's Scott's question. Statistical confidence interval is defined as an interval bounded by confidence limit, so there's no absolute truth, statistically speaking. I see. So the claim would be, statistically speaking, all you can show is that something is true within certain confidence limits. But that, well, that, I'm sure is that you're right. That's what we mean by statistical confidence interval. But that would only show that that's only showing how we use a certain concept in statistics. That wouldn't settle the question of whether there's such a thing as something that's true 100%. That would just show that's not a concept. It's not a statistical concept. But we don't have any general argument with one, at least one that I know that our concepts are limited to ones that can be used in statistics. I want to thank everybody for putting up with me for this lecture, and I hope we'll see you next week. And thanks very much, everybody. Thanks for coming. See you next week. Bye, everybody.